Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. Your feedback is always welcome. You can get in touch with me through Twitter with the handle @InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. My name is Sean Delaney and I'll be with you for the next half an hour or thereabouts. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Marilyn Cochrane-Smith. As well as being Professor of Teacher Education for Urban Schools and the Director of the Doctorate Programme in Curriculum and Instruction at the Lynch School of Education in Boston College, she is a former President of the American Educational Research Association. And it was at the 2015 annual conference of the American Educational Research Association held earlier this year in Chicago that I recorded the interview. In the second part of my interview, I noted that Marilyn made a few mentions to the need for teachers to be conscious of matters of inequity in the education system and matters of social justice. For example, on last week's programme, when I asked her about the key requirements for preparing beginning teachers, part of her answer was as follows.
People really have to have thought carefully about the inequities that exist in the educational system and what produces those inequities and what the role of the teacher is and what the role of teacher preparation is. So teachers can't fix everything, and they can't alone, they can't cure the systems of inequality that exist practically in every society around the world, but they can do important things. So I think teacher candidates have to have thought a lot about that. What does it mean to be trying to work with other people so that the goal of teaching is equity and challenging inequity? Teachers have to have thought a lot about and figured out what it means in action, not just thought about it, about what we often call deficit viewpoints. And then they have to have figured out a way to not have a deficit viewpoint, but rather have what some people call an asset viewpoint. So if you see these kids, I'm saying in quotation marks, who come from a lower socioeconomic background, do you assume that that's a deficit? Automatically, that's a deficit. They don't have this. They don't have that. Their parents probably don't care about school. That's why they don't come to the school meetings, you know, the parent meetings. Maybe they're not first language speakers of English, the language of instruction in school. They can't speak English. That's a deficit, etc. Now, if you flip it and you say, what do they bring? What are the cultural and linguistic and other kinds of resources they bring that we can build on in school? For example, there's a really big difference between saying that person doesn't speak English as a first language and saying this person is a bilingual learner. They already speak one language and now they're learning another.
On the practice of giving novices full responsibility for teaching a class before they have had time to attend teacher education coursework, she made the following point.
It certainly needs to not be the case that you get all the classroom experience first while you're learning on the kids, because I just think we have to wonder what are they doing while you're learning on them. And in the U.S., a lot of the kids who end up with teachers who are not well prepared and are new are the very kids who are already disadvantaged. So if they get year after year people who are learning on them, I think it simply exacerbates the various kinds of inequities that we have in the system.
So given Marilyn Cochrane-Smith's stance on these matters, I asked her what future teachers need to learn about social justice.
One of the things I think they have to know is that there isn't an even playing field in the schools or in society writ larger. A lot of teacher candidates come into programs, and I think this is true in Ireland as well as in the U.S. because St. Patrick's used our social justice scale with some of your teacher candidates, and we got similar results to what we have to what we have from Boston College. So a lot of teacher candidates come into programs really believing that our American society or some other country is a meritocracy. You know, how you do depends on how hard you work. And if you work hard, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you know, you will do just fine. So trying to help teacher candidates understand it's not a meritocracy, that idea to start with is pretty complicated. How do you come to understand that? That some people are privileged by virtue of being born into whatever they're born into. And they didn't earn it. They have certain advantages by virtue of race, class, culture, language background, gender. And that those advantages help them succeed in school in ways that are invisible if we haven't unpacked and paid attention. By the same token, groups that have been historically disadvantaged come in without those privileges. So that's a big idea for teacher candidates eventually to come to. And it's not something that you can just tell them and then they get, and it's not something they can just read about over a short period of time and come to understand.
So how do they come to understand it?
Well, I mean, certainly reading helps. Observations in a variety of communities. There are lots of articles and activities that help people start to unpack who they are, what they bring, what their own advantages have been. And there's often resistance to these ideas as well, because we don't like to think that we have succeeded for reasons other than that we deserve it and that we worked hard. But I think there are lots of ways to get people over time and eventually to recognize. One way of getting at some of these issues is to look statistically at what is the impact of socioeconomic status on kids? What is the impact of race on school success? Now, if you see a big difference, what are the explanations for that? Either you think, well, those kids didn't deserve to get there and they didn't work hard, so that's why. Or maybe there's something else going on. So we don't want people to think there aren't human differences. Of course there are. And there are always going to be differences in how people do in schools. But the idea is we don't want those differences to be able to be so well predicted by socioeconomic status or race, class, culture, gender, ethnicity. So, but it's a hard thing to come to.
But even when you do come to that understanding that there is not a meritocracy, it's another step, isn't it, to know that as a teacher you can do something about it.
Right.
So what can teachers do about it, and how do they actually learn that?
And the thing is, they can't do, I think I said this already at the beginning, but they can't do everything about it. They can't fix it. So not only are we asking them to come to this hard understanding that it's not a meritocracy, that's the first, and then we're asking them to come to terms with, and as a teacher, you can have an impact, but you can't solve it. So there's this tension. So what can you do? Okay, so there are certainly classroom strategies. For example, there are very explicit strategies for working effectively with English language learners. You don't know how to do those just because you're smart. You're not born knowing how to do those. So people who say born teachers, you know, I think there are some aspects of personality that help people with teaching, but there are very specific strategies about understanding the language demands of different kinds of activities. We have to learn these things. So that's sort of one area. There's these very specific strategies. Then there are more general, what I would call principles, and I've been working with a group of research colleagues in New Zealand where we also have this problem of inequity, but of a different kind from Ireland, a different kind from the U.S., and we've been working on developing this idea that we're calling patterns of practice for equity. And the patterns word is really important because it's kind of a broader level, broader level cluster of beliefs and values and strategies and interpretive frames. So, for example, building positive relationships with students. Teaching is relational. If you're going to be effective, if you're going to try to challenge inequities, if you're going to be effective, particularly with people who've been historically marginalized, you have to know how to make relationships with them, respectful relationships, build on what they bring to school, communicate with their families, all of those kinds of things. You can learn to do that. So they're sort of a cluster of notions like that. And then third, at least, is also realizing that working to challenge inequity is a collective activity. It's not just the teacher in his or her own classroom, and it's not even just the teachers at a particular school. So you can help people think about how do you learn to work with others in larger social movements who are challenging inequity. So all over the world, for example, right now, there are protests about growing income inequality. And that's a problem. Perhaps it's not in every country, but it's in a whole lot of them. So as a teacher, are you going to join with others to challenge those kinds of things? Doesn't mean every teacher has to be out on the street protesting, but some of them might be. So it's figuring out how to be an advocate and how to be an activist. And this is something that's complicated. And there's pushback on this idea.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, there is a certain level of political involvement or a certain level of political awareness. And although, say, for example, very few might question the role of a teacher being an advocate for social justice, supposing they were to advocate something else that was politically popular but actually might ethically be questionable, doesn't that pose questions or pose difficulties for teaching if it becomes more political?
Let me say something about teaching being political. So I think part of the whole concept of teaching for social justice, one of the basic assumptions is that teaching is political, period. Always has been, always will be. So this viewpoint isn't advocating that we are trying to politicize teaching. It's saying we are trying to acknowledge that it has always been political and that you as a teacher are involved in a political phenomenon either by design or by default. And part of teacher preparation is helping people think, by design, how am I going to be engaged? So if I'll give you an example. So if you are in a school where they are tracking children, I don't know if you use that term in Ireland, or some countries say streaming, where kids are very early on divided by what appears to be their ability or level of competence in some area, and then they get differential curriculum, differential instructional time, perhaps, more or less opportunity to be engaged in rich curriculum. This, we have tons of research that says that this is problematic and says that the people who lose are the people who are in the lower tracks and who historically have been those disadvantaged by the system for a long time. So let's say you're in a school that's doing that. Okay, so then, as a teacher who's working for equity, can you begin to raise questions about that? Can you propose that you untrack certain aspects of the educational systems? Can you find other teachers who see it that way too, and can you work together? Now, I'm not suggesting that student teachers who aren't even finished with preparation or first-year teachers walk into their school and start challenging everything, because that's probably not going to help anybody, and it's probably going to end up with them in trouble or unhappy or not in the job, I don't know. But I don't think it's something that you can just wait. Well, you know, when I'm really experienced, give me 5 years, then I'll start to work for justice. This has to be something that is part of the job right along. So I want people to learn that teaching for equity or teaching for social justice is part of the job of teaching, period. And then, but then you figure out how can you maybe take some baby steps toward that as a student teacher, and then maybe a few more steps toward that as a first-year teacher, and then find others to challenge. So in some schools, for example, over time, and this was people who were researching their own teaching, they have untracked AP courses. Do you have that in Ireland?
No, but they're advanced for high achievers.
So. Yes, yeah, advanced placement. And the attraction in the U.S. is then you can count that for college credit. So these are high school things. So there are some schools where, because teachers initiated it, they untracked AP English and made it open to anybody who would commit to doing the work, even if they didn't have the test scores or the grade point that would have required that. And it was a teacher research study. Well, what will happen if we do that? And it's a long, complicated answer to the question. There's some interesting articles about it. But one of the things they found was that many kids could reach a particular level of performance in a mixed class. Didn't have to be tracked. And everybody got richer opportunities, and many of them passed the AP test as well. So a group of teachers looked at tracking. They said, we think this is really limiting the opportunities of some people. What if we try something else? And let's look at it carefully. Let's document it. And then we'll regroup and rethink. I don't mean regroup like retrack, but, you know, and we'll move forward.
Do it a different way.
Yeah. So that's an example, I think, of challenging inequities in a school.
I want to move on to another area now, Marilyn, because you've written about teachers being researchers. Mm-hmm. How do you see the role of a teacher in research at this stage?
This is something that, again, I think should be part of the activity of teaching and should be understood to be part of teaching right from the beginning. So, in other words, I'm not a person who says, well, maybe teachers can be researchers, but 5 years down the road, you know, once they get their sea legs under them. I think that if you see teaching as a research activity, in a sense, an inquiry activity in the first place, then even student teachers, very, very young, can be engaged. And there's sort of a continuum of what does it mean to be a researching teacher or an inquiring teacher. So one aspect of it is trying to unpack what's going on. And I've said this several times now. Trying to uncover and identify and rethink your own assumptions about kids, about their families, about language. That's part of teacher research or inquiry in a broader sense. All the way to the other end of the continuum, where a teacher is doing an explicit, specific study in her own classroom or her own school. So I'll give you an example, which will be interesting for the Ireland context. So one of my former students was a female English teacher in an all-boys Catholic high school, one of the few female faculty members. And she had been there a number of years, and she learned with me about doing teacher research. And so she wanted to look more carefully at what was going on with gender in the school because she was uncomfortable about a lot of things. And so she eventually did a study with data and questions, you know, that looks more like any other study. She wanted to know how she and her students, her boy students, constructed gender in her English classes. She wanted to know what insights and ideas and understandings would develop if she did a unit that was specifically intended to bring gender issues to the surface in terms of the novels they read and so on. And then she wanted to know sort of how all this was influenced by the larger culture of the school. Those were more or less her research questions, and this was a qualitative teacher research study. So she audio recorded classroom discussions around these novels that she had planned. And she did all this with permission and informed consent of the kids and their parents. She kept a teacher's journal for like a year and a half with all of her own questions and reflections and unpacking and rethinking and thinking, etc. She looked at the kids' work and she interviewed a selected number of the boys in her classes. And she was able to do an analysis about what was happening in the school. And without going into long detail, she uncovered things that she was not thrilled about and uncovered her own complicity in some of it as well, in terms of the way, despite a stated mission of inclusiveness for the school and sort of multicultural inclusive curriculum, in fact, she discovered that there was a kind of construction of girls and women as the other and as less than, and there, I won't say it was misogynist, but there were definite issues. So that's an example of a complete, in-depth classroom study. That's a teacher researcher.
And that's one end of the continuum.
That's one end of the continuum. The other end of the continuum is this ongoing, we call inquiry stance, where you're raising questions, rethinking, challenging, looking back, looking forward, connecting. And I think if you're a researching teacher, you're always taking an inquiry stance, but you're not necessarily always engaged in a more formal study. And then along the way, there are all sorts of little studies and less formal and...
I suppose I'm wondering, does that merit the title, though, research? I mean, is that really just reflecting on action? Is it reflecting on practice? What actually makes it research, if a teacher is just thinking about what they did yesterday?
I'm not saying it's not just thinking about what you're doing. So I think that inquiry and taking an inquiry stance is more than just reflecting, but it includes reflecting, and sort of depending on whose definition we're using, there might be a point along the continuum where you'd say, okay, that one, I think I'll start to say it's research there. When Susan Lytle and I first began to write about this 30 years ago, the first book we wrote was called Teacher Research and Knowledge, and we specifically chose to call it research and specifically chose knowledge because we wanted to make the argument that outside, as in usually university-based, formal research about teachers, where teachers are the object of study, is not the only way to know about teaching. And that those who are inside the work, by virtue of being there every day and in very, very close connection with kids, that they know some things as well, and that if they engage in this process systematically, they can generate even what we might call knowledge with a capital K, in addition to what outside researchers engage in. Now, there's probably a funny kind of muddled line about when does it become knowledge and when does it become research. Over the years, Susan Lytle and I have chosen to use the word inquiry, which is a softer word than research. And yet our second book, which came out in 2009, is called Inquiry as Stance, Practitioner Research for the Next Generation. So we again chose to use the word research because we're really trying to challenge politically the idea that it's only outside university researchers taking teaching and teachers as objects of study who can construct knowledge.
But I suppose, is it reasonable for a teacher to be expected to do research as well as to do all the other work? Say, for example, if I have a mm-hmm. bundle of student work to correct in the evening, mm-hmm. and I can choose between doing that or doing some research or inquiry in my own teaching. Mm-hmm. How should I make that decision?
That's a good question, and fair enough. But the part of the idea here is to help people understand that research is part of the activity of teaching. And the reason people do it isn't because they want to complete a paper and fly to Chicago at AERA and present it, but because it makes them better teachers. And in my experience, if teachers don't see the activity of teacher research as improving their practice, they don't do it. Because they don't have time, as you were just asking. But if they have ways to systematically look at issues in their classroom that might not necessarily look like formal researchers' methods. So the example I gave you, that's why I said it's way on that end of the continuum, far on the end of the continuum, because that looks as much like a formal qualitative study about a classroom, except it's done from an insider's perspective, which makes a difference. But there are all sorts of less formal ways, but they're still systematic ways of looking. So many of the teacher researchers I know, for example, at the primary level, use a set of descriptive processes for looking at students. And they have a set of categories by which they describe students. They have a posing question about supporting a kid in a particular way. They bring in the data of the classroom. They bring in the student's work. They bring in descriptions of the student. And then together, a group asks questions, looks at the data, explores it, and come to recommendations. I think that's teacher research. It's not, they're not going to publish that. And it doesn't look like the formal research that we might expect. But it's very valuable information, but it's for the local context, not necessarily the broader context.
Marilyn, so much more we could discuss, but we've run out of time, so thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, and hello to all my friends in Ireland.
And indeed, Marilyn Cochrane-Smith has made many friends in Ireland through her contributions to conferences and to research courses in St. Patrick's College. Well, that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. Thanks to my guest, Marilyn Cochrane-Smith from Boston College, for her time. If you'd like to feature an idea or recommend a guest for a future programme, please write to me by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. You can listen to over 220 podcasts of previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.